This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Every life is full of twists and turns, dead ends and fortuitous opportunities. Scientists are no exception. Phil Richardson grew up on a ranch north of San Francisco. His father and grandfather were both architects, so that seemed like a natural career choice, but it didn't quite work out. Instead, Richardson became a physical oceanographer. Then, in 1997, he became fascinated with albatrosses. 14 years later, he published a study of albatross aerodynamics. His insights are now helping engineers construct remote-controlled aerial gliders. Phil Richardson is scientist emeritus in the Physical Oceanography Department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and he joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Phil Richardson, welcome to Living Lab.
Good, thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, tell me about that research cruise in 1997 when the albatrosses really first caught your attention. What were you out there to do in the first place?
Well, it was an international study of the water flow from the Indian Ocean around South Africa into the Atlantic. And we put out floats and surface drifters to actually track the water. And it was my first cruise in the far South Atlantic. So we left from Cape Town, steamed west, and it was the first albatrosses I'd ever seen. And I found it totally amazing. We were steaming upwind, and the albatrosses were catching the ship from astern.
They were actually overtaking you.
They were overtaking us. We were steaming at 12 knots, and the wind was about 15 knots on our nose. And the birds, the albatrosses, were not flapping their wings. They were soaring. And so what seemed very amazing to me was, how could they soar upwind much faster than the wind and catching the ship? So how are they doing that? And I remember I stood on the fantail watching them for several hours until I had to go do some real work.
I was going to say, is there a lot of downtime in the research that you were doing that you were able to?
Well, we were leaving port and heading for the first station. And so we were just steaming along. And I kept telling people, wasn't this wonderful? And I said, well, yeah, it looks great. I think I'll get a cup of coffee. And then they all disappeared. But I stood there for hours trying to figure out how they were doing it. And scratching my head. And then, of course, we got very busy in our work. We were launching floats and moorings and so forth. So I really didn't do anything about it for several more years.
So you got interested in this. You're wondering how they could actually soar like this. Presumably went to see what was known about it. What was known about how albatrosses could soar like this?
Well, many years later, about 5 years ago, there was a nice piece in National Geographic written by Carl Safina. And he's a biologist, so his focus on biology, but he talks a little bit about the dynamic soaring, as it was called. Well, I didn't know what dynamic soaring was. Although when I first saw them soaring, it seemed like they were probably using updrafts over the waves, but they had a very peculiar way of flying that suggested maybe they were doing something about the wind gradients. And so, so after reading his article, I followed up and started doing some research. And one of the problems I ran into is that most biologists who write about albatrosses are worried about where they go, where they feed, their life cycle. And they don't really seem to care much about the details of how they're flying. So then I looked at some of the aerodynamics papers, and they're very complicated. As you can imagine, if you write the equations for a bird flying in wind shear over waves, it's very complicated. There's the angle the bird's going with respect to the horizon, with respect to the wind, the bank angle, the drag, the lift. It's pretty complicated. And so these papers would tend to end up with some result. And, you know, I just didn't get much of a feeling for it. So there seemed to be this.
You're a physicist.
You're
used to looking at complicated equations for how the ocean moves.
Well,
and yet this was.
Well, I'm an observationalist. So I tend to put buoys and floats out and try to make sense out of what they're doing and try to infer what the ocean is doing and what the dynamics are. Ocean eddies and ocean currents like the Gulf Stream are my specialty. So in graduate school, I used to know a lot about the dynamical equations, but I haven't really been doing that much recently. And I've never done aerodynamics equations. And they're different. If you're not used to doing them, they're a little hard to figure out.
So as you're reading these papers, trying to figure out what's known about how albatrosses can soar so incredibly, did you ever consider kind of giving up on it? I mean, these are complicated equations. They're figuring out the aerodynamics. Somebody else is doing it, but it's kind of over my head and just kind of dropping it.
Oh, I totally gave up on it. And I kept thinking there must be a simple way. I mean, I understand, I think, how a pendulum works. You know, you lift up the bob, say, of a grandfather clock, and you let it go, and it's moving down. At the bottom, it's going fast, and it rises up. So you're trading potential energy for kinetic energy. So it seemed to be something like that must work with these birds.
Okay, so let's go back to actually observing the birds. And you said they have a peculiar way of flying. Describe, they're not just soaring straight ahead at one level. Describe what it looks like, how an albatross is actually soaring.
Well, they use the waves. In the Southern Ocean, usually they're big waves and big winds.
Right.
And so typically what they do is they start in a wave trough, and there's very little wind there. And then they turn into the wind and climb upwind.
So up, both up into the wind and physically up.
Physically, they're moving up. So what's happening, they're going from no wind up into a strong wind, and they're headed into it. So suddenly their airspeed, the speed they're going through the air, suddenly goes up quite a bit. And then they turn, and as they turn and head downwind while they're up high, mm-hmm. they're not very high, but maybe 30 feet or so. And so then they're going downwind, and they have the wind behind them. So they're going at their speed plus the wind speed. And over the ground, they have the sum of those two. So when they dive back down into a wave trough, they're now going faster than they were before. So they're getting energy. And so they're using the gradient of the wind gradient, to increase their airspeed or kinetic energy, and they can use that to climb and then dive back down again.
It's kind of this circuitous up and down and up and down, but still making progress in one direction.
So if they want, the usual direction they go is perpendicular to the wind. I mean, they can go upwind, and I've been working on that problem, how they do that. But the usual direction, it seems to be easy for them, is to go across wind. And so they climb up into the wind and dive back down into a wave trough and keep doing this S-shaped maneuver. And they can just keep doing it all day, no flapping.
I mean, you said the biologists don't really concern themselves with how the birds fly. But if they're primarily determining their direction, I mean, these birds spend most of their lives out over the ocean. If they're mostly determining where they fly based on the wind direction, that would seem to have biological ramifications, where they can go.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And biologists have put GPSs on them and tracked them over long distances. And these tracks are wonderful. They fly around the world. 45 days is a fastest that they've ever recorded. And what I loved is when you see GPS tracks, they tend to go towards, a lot of them live in South Georgia Island in the Southern Ocean.
Right, in the Southern Atlantic.
South Atlantic. And they go to feed often around South Africa. And you see them pretty much like a beeline head up there. And then there's very convoluted tracks where they're feeding along the edge of the continent. And then sometimes they then take off and head over towards South America, and they're working, feeding off the shelf of South America, say off Argentina. And then it looks like, okay, they decide it's time to go home, and they come straight back to South Georgia Island, you know.
So somehow it seems that they're essentially making decisions about where they want to go.
Yeah, either they're reading their GPS or they don't need to read it, and they just know where they're going.
And they're able to do that somehow with the wind conditions, whatever they are.
Yeah, and some of the young ones, when they leave, they don't come back for 5 or 6 years. They've been flying around the world for many years, and then they show up back at their home site.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with oceanographer Phil Richardson about his varied career in ocean science, most recently his studies of how albatrosses are able to glide so efficiently. Now, we were talking about how complicated the aerodynamics of this gliding is and what was known at the point, 1997, then a few years later, 2000 or so, as you were first getting interested in this problem. You are somewhat known for taking some of these complex problems like ocean circulation, or in this case, the soaring of albatrosses, and being able to distill that down to not an oversimplified, but a simple graphic form that can help you get a handle on it. describe how you did that for the albatrosses. What was kind of the breakthrough in being able to describe this complicated soaring process simply and graphically?
Right. So, when I was thinking about it, I kept thinking, well, this must be a whole lot easier than some of the aerodynamicists seem to be making of it. And the usual solution to complicated problems is you make a lot of simplifying assumptions, and then you try to solve equations with the simplified equations, which is much easier. Then, of course, you have to, investigate whether those are reasonable assumptions.
So somehow you're going to have to get back to the full complexity of the problem.
See if it actually worked. And so it seemed to me the simple balance was the bird is climbing up from no wind regime into the strong wind and then maneuvering and then diving back down again. And the original description of this, of how a bird might soar. Of course, everyone knows a bird can soar using thermals and updrafts. But
we see hawks over the highway do this kind of thing.
Or hear the seagulls over the Martha's Vineyard ferry and all that sort of stuff, updrafts. But the first description that actually talked about how to use the gradient of the wind shear, was by Lord Rayleigh in 1883. And his description seemed perfectly reasonable these days. He assumed a two-layer model, a lower layer with no wind speed at all, and the upper layer with a wind speed. And so you can imagine that if a bird flies from no wind, headed into the wind, and climbs up, suddenly his airspeed increases. If he then turns and heads downwind and drops back into the low wind, his airspeed increases again.
I mean, he's caught a tailwind, essentially.
Yeah. And so in this maneuver, he originally talked about a sort of a circular flight, because he was trying to describe vultures that were spiraling upward. And anyway, his description seemed great. So I just said, well, why not have a two-layer model that seems to be match what the albatrosses are doing, low wind in the wave trough, strong wind just above it. And so there would be a simple balance in this model, which is the bird gains airspeed by climbing across the wind shear layer, and then there's drag on the bird, normal drag from the shape of the
gravity, friction.
Well, gravity is always pulling him down, so that's a force that's forcing him down, and the lift of his wings is keeping him up, but he has to keep moving fairly fast, so he needs a thrust, and the thrust is the climbing up into the wind, the strong wind. It's like if you come around the side of a house, behind a house in a strong wind, there's no wind. You come around the edge and suddenly there's this blast in your face, a very strong wind. So it's the same sort of idea. Hmm. So it was a little complicated to figure out how to write the equations for the drag of a bird that's banked and soaring. And again, I simplified it, assumed it was linear. The drag is actually, it's quadratic. And you have to make a certain assumption. So one was that the drag coefficient is proportional, lift coefficient squared. And at this point, I'd actually found an aerodynamicist who was interested in talking about this. And he'd worked on a lot of problems. And was very friendly, Peter Liesemann, who also worked on the Gossamer Condor and man-powered flight. And so I came up with a model and then started talking to him about it. And he offered some suggestions. And so I ended up just kept working on it, and it seemed to work. It seemed to explain. And he had a more complicated model, a real aerodynamic model, numerical model. And so I compared my results with his, and they agreed almost perfectly. So I thought that was really encouraging. And then I found another paper that was also aerodynamics of dynamic soaring, and my results compared well with his. So I was quite encouraged. The nice thing about mine was it's simple enough so you can see what's going on. I mean, it's a simple balance, just friction versus the increase in airspeed. So what you're doing is balancing drag with increase of kinetic energy by the wind.
How difficult is it to shift from something? I mean, you can see there might be parallels between fluid dynamics, how the ocean is moving, and aerodynamics, but how difficult is it to make that shift? You're clearly an intelligent person and can educate yourself on this, but logistically, you know, just how difficult is it to shift gears in terms of your research?
Well, I had a previous experience where I had been working with the historical ship drift data. So 20, 30 years ago, the best data of ocean currents was made by ships steaming along. With good navigation, they could tell that their course was shifted by ocean currents. And so there's a large compilation of these data. And people were using them to map ocean currents, and I was too. But there was a lot of criticism of those. They said, well, you know, there's so many errors involved. And then people kept saying, well, you know, the wind's blowing on the side of the ship. It's going to push it through the water, so you can't really rely on the measurements you're making. And so at one point, I decided to look at that. And again, it's sort of a similar project to the Albatross one, because then you have a ship steaming through the water, and then you have wind blowing on the side. So you're developing lift, and there's drag. Of course, the engine of the ship's propeller is keeping it going. And so it's a complicated set of equations. And it turns out the people who design ships have been working on this for a long time, so it's a big body of knowledge. So I started trying to figure this out and came up with what I thought was reasonable results. But then, you know, the thought occurred to me that ships steam along the same track line often across the ocean. So they go one way, say, from Europe to the U.S., and they turn around and go back. And they go back and forth along the same track. Other track lines head in a perpendicular direction to that. So I figured out that if you use the data from the two sets of track lines, you can then estimate what the leeway, which is the error people were worried about, leeway was. And so I actually did the calculation, and it turned out it agrees with the theory, which is it's not a big problem.
I mean, basically what you're saying, the theme here is that simplifying it and essentially fresh eyes coming in, trying to find the simplest explanation, not trying to delve into all of the most expert details, can sometimes actually reveal real insights.
So I used the results of the modeling by all the ship people and then actually used the observations, and they matched up pretty well. And the surprising thing for me, the result there was that the sideways drift of a ship with the wind blowing on its side is very small. And the reason is because if you imagine trying to push on a ship, the ship develops lift, just like an airplane or an albatross does, and the lift counters the push. And so the downwind leeway is quite small. And as a comparison, people have been using surface drifters tracked by satellite, and these tend to have a big drogue on them so that the wind won't just push the surface part. And the drogue is much, much bigger than the surface part. And it turns out that the sideways leeway of a ship in the wind is about the same as a drogued surface drifter. So they were both equally good. People believed surface drifters, but they tended not to believe the ship drifts. And of course, one of the problems is it's hard to check what was happening with the navigation on these ships. You can't go back and look at millions and millions of data to verify what you think is right.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is oceanographer Phil Richardson. We'll talk more about his early life and family ties to oceanography after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Dr. Phil Richardson, scientist emeritus at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Phil, your father died very early in your life, and your mother remarried. Your stepfather was George Wheelwright III, known to most as the co-founder of Polaroid. And you grew up on his ranch north of San Francisco. Was it an active ranch? What was it like growing up on that ranch?
It was great growing up on a ranch. Originally, they started with horses and gave riding lessons and would take people on treks and camping trips and things. And it turned out that was a huge amount of effort and not much money. So after a couple of years, they stopped doing that, and my father started with Hereford beef cattle. And originally, they were sort of range cattle, and he would you know, raise them and sell them for beef. And he got more and more interested in the registered stock and breeding and had visited lots of ranches around. And so over the years, he increased the kinds of animals he had. So he had some first-rate bulls, very classy bulls, some which came from England. He flew them over, believe it or not, and was trying to promote Hereford cattle in this country. And so I grew up on the ranch, and I used to take breaks from school, go on roundups, and it was a lot of fun. I spent a lot of time building fences or mending fences and doing the normal things on a ranch.
And then you also, then often your family summered in Maine, I take it. Where were you in Maine?
On island of Vinalhaven.
Hmm.
And my stepfather had spent his youth there, and his father had, and his grandfather had. And so we used to go there summers for a few weeks or longer, and he ended up buying a little house. And he loved sailing, so he had a little sailboat, and we sailed around and had a great time. I loved it up there.
Now, your stepfather was also, a flight navigator during World War II. And in addition to the sailing, you grew up with a love of flying. And how old were you? You got your pilot's license at a relatively young age.
Well, yeah, my stepfather was a navigator during the war, so when I was young, I heard a lot of stories, and he had pilot friends, so I always heard a lot about airplanes, and I was just one of the kids who liked building airplanes and, you know, made one with a gas-powered motor and flew that and crashed it a lot, and I know my dad and his friends laughed a lot, but it was a lot of fun, and gradually I worked up until I finally built a radio-controlled glider and flew that. And then I built a radio-controlled bigger airplane and flew that. And finally I decided, hey, I want to fly real airplanes. So I signed up for flight lessons up in Plymouth. And it turns out there several friends were doing it at the same time, Jim Price here and several others. So it was like a hooey Air Force group. We used to joke about ourselves. And it was really fun. I enjoyed it.
So that was you knew these folks that you now know at HUI before your days here.
Well, this is while I was at HUI now
okay.
I took the actual flying lessons, real flying lessons, not model airplane flying lessons.
Now, you originally thought that you might follow in the footsteps of your father and grandfather. Your grandfather, a rather renowned architect, you went to school for civil engineering, but you say that it just didn't take. What wasn't right about architecture or civil engineering for you?
Well, when I went to college, I was at Berkeley, and I really didn't know what to major in. And so many members of the family being in architecture, I thought I'd try that. And I studied architecture for a year, but I tended to like the engineering courses better than the so-called architecture courses. And most of the architects hated the engineering courses, and they loved the design classes. So I said, well, maybe this is telling me something. And then I got interested in some of the really good civil engineers who built wonderful structures, wonderful bridges. And so I thought, well, maybe if I major in civil engineering, I could end up in architecture or structural engineering. And so I ended up graduating in that as a structural engineer.
With your background in sailing and flying and your love, I mean, you said built essentially remote-controlled planes, gliders. Did that ever occur to you as a possible career path?
No. I thought I had to get a real job, and you know, all that seemed to be sort of fun, and I had never really thought of it as a potential job. But you know, maybe I should have. I did one of those tests, you know, where they're supposed to tell you what you'd be good at, and aviator was up there on the top of the list. So maybe I should have spent more time doing that.
Now, when you graduated from Berkeley, you chose to serve in the Coast and Geodetic Survey. This is kind of a precursor to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. What were you doing as part of that service?
Nautical charting, mainly. We were based in Norfolk, Virginia, and were on ships that went up and down the East Coast and worked in the Caribbean, around Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. And so we're just surveying on the ship and then at nights plotting up our measurements, and they would eventually be turned into the regular nautical charts that you go by these days, which are probably now all online as opposed to the the nice printed ones we used to make.
I mean, the Coast and Geodetic Survey, I know, actually surveyed quite a while ago the national seashore, and even up onto the beach was responsible for part of that. And then several weeks ago, we actually at Living Lab spoke with a number of folks from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and elsewhere about the messages in bottles that used to be used to study ocean currents, and the Coast and Geodetic Survey was involved in that as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, it was sort of fun. You know, the areas we worked in, worked south side of Martha's Vineyard and around the Shoals, Mattaquette Harbor, and Nantucket. And when you start a survey, usually you get the last survey that was done, and you use that for a basis for planning your work. And I remember getting this old chart and looking at it, and I thought, these guys, I mean, this is crazy. They're zigzagging all over the place. These guys aren't very good, you know, because our lines, we're doing radio navigation. And so it's very important to do straight lines and then move over and come back, you know, like 50 meters from the last line. And then to finally realize, you look at the dates, 1800, these guys are sailing and using lead lines. So, you know, it's been a long time since the surveys had been done. So it was fun. It was fun to do those areas. And, of course, we got to go ashore on the Vineyard and Nantucket and explore those islands. And part of the survey work, you have to build monuments on shore, which you use for visual navigation when you're close. And then you put in tide gauges to measure how high the water is. And then, because you have to correct your soundings. And
What do you build those monuments out of? Are they essentially just piles of stones, or are they something more sturdily constructed?
Well, you try to do as cheaply as you can. So maybe an A-frame made out of three boards with a white tarp on it is a good one. And if you can, you use chimneys of houses. The trouble is on Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, you say red roof, gray house, you know, and there are like 3 million of them. So you have to build your own, otherwise you can't. It's very difficult to pick items like that from a house because they all have this standardized look.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with oceanographer Phil Richardson. Now, Phil, on your mother's side, I take it Columbus Islin, one of the early directors of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, was a cousin of yours. And at some point while serving with the Coast and Geodetic Survey, you were tied up here in Woods Hole and had a conversation with your cousin, Columbus Islin, that ended up changing or setting the course of your career from there.
Right. Well, as in between our surveys, we ended up in Woods Hole, and my mother sort of convinced me I should go talk to him, you know, about oceanography. And so I made an appointment and stopped in, and we talked about graduate school. And, you know, the two leading ones right here are MIT and University of Rhode Island. And he told me, Columbus told me, that they had a new dean at URI, John Knaus, who was really good and a physical oceanographer, and that's sort of what I was interested in. And so I went over and saw him, and URI seemed very nice, good program, good people. And so I ended up going to graduate school there for 8 years, a long time.
You got 2 degrees in that time, though, we should say.
Yeah. Well, I got a master's because I wasn't sure if I really wanted to commit to this, and then had a great time with John Knaus, and so I stayed, got a PhD.
Now, at that point, I mean, you're making the choice about graduate schools. The program now between MIT and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is one of the leading programs in the country, but that had barely gotten started or wasn't even officially underway at that point, right?
Right. It really wasn't an oceanography department yet, I don't think. And so, you know, I went for a real oceanography department. By real, I mean they had different parts. They had biological oceanography, geological oceanography, physical, chemical. And when you started out, you took a core course in each of those. So they tried to make the different fields all connected, which made sense to me. Whereas MIT seemed a little daunting in those days. And so I decided to go for URI.
That broad base, having every student take courses in each discipline within oceanography, is now what the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution program does for its students. And Do you feel like that produces perhaps a different outlook than oceanographers who might have been trained strictly in physical oceanography, that you might be more prone to going out on a ship to do physical oceanography research, but get distracted in a good way by this other question of the albatrosses soaring, and perhaps feel that you have the ability to jump to that kind of question?
Well, I think when I started, the field of physical oceanography was pretty simple, and most of the fields were fairly simple, looking at it from today's perspective. And so it made sense to try to study your field. But then it became pretty clear that if you wanted to understand the biology, you also had to understand the physics and the chemistry. So it became really important to work with others. And right after I came here, I did a project with Peter Wiebe here and several others studying Gulf Stream rings, Gulf Stream eddies. And we're looking at the life in that's trapped in one of these eddies when it pinches off from the Gulf Stream. And I was looking at the physics and what happens to them. And it was very interesting. So we would share time. So Peter would be out there collecting all the animals that he would collect, which was fun to watch them. And Dick Backus was collecting fish, and I was collecting CTD measurements. But it was great, and it was fun to see the different aspects.
I'm talking with oceanographer Phil Richardson. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with Dr. Phil Richardson, scientist emeritus in the Department of Physical Oceanography at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Before the break, we were talking about coming here to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution as a faculty member. And your early research was kind of a next generation from something we talked about a few weeks ago, which was using drifter bottles to study ocean currents, literally throwing messages in bottles into the ocean to see where they ended up. By the time you joined the faculty at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, how much had the technology progressed?
Well, when I started oceanography, it was very difficult to make measurements in the deep ocean. Deep moored current meters had just been developed, but they usually didn't work very well. And it was very risky. Often they didn't come back. As you can imagine, deep sea moorings were tricky. It's hard to get what you launch back. Chances, high pressure, salty water, all these things make for a difficult instrument. One of the first big experiments was a line of moored current meters across the Gulf Stream. And all the ones in the Gulf Stream went away because the currents were so strong. So you can imagine the problems, and they're the torque of the wire, so the current meters would spin. They get pulled under by the strong currents. The vibration would break wire. There are just so many problems. That just took a long time to work out the problems. And at the same time, there's a parallel development, which were deep floats. And deep floats are fun because if you launch them somewhere, they drift with the current. So they actually tell you where the water is going and where it ends up. The problem was when they first started doing it, you had to track them from ships acoustically. So you lower a transducer and listen for where they were.
So they're kind of pinging and you're trying to follow that pinging.
And you're trying to follow them. And one of the first studies was near Bermuda. And so they put all these floats out and they thought, well, they'd figure out where they were and then go into Bermuda and wait around and come back out and find out where they were again. But they couldn't find them. It turned out, because they were thinking that in the deepish water of the Atlantic, the currents are very weak. Well, it turned out they're very, very strong and erratic in the sense they're ocean eddies. And so that was the discovery of ocean eddies, mid-ocean eddies, which was one of the big discoveries in physical oceanography in the 60s and 70s. And so people said, well, that's great, but we need a longer-term float, something that will last for a long time and that we can track from shore stations. Well, it turned out the Navy had listening stations for, when a plane was down, they'd drop essentially a bomb that would go off. And they had these stations that could hear that. And so if a plane went down, they would know where the plane was and could try to go rescue them. And so Tom Rossby and Doug Webb developed the SOFAR float. So it was a float. There's a sound channel at about 1,000 meters depth called the sound channel. And
what does that mean, a sound channel?
Oh, good question. Above that depth, the speed of sound increases as you move up into the warmer and warmer water. Below 1,000 meters, the pressure increases, which also increases the speed of sound. So it's like a lens. So sound travels long distances at about 1,000 meters in the Atlantic. And people have had sound that went around the world.
Fascinating.
So anyway.
So you were using the sound channel to figure out how the ocean was moving.
Tom Rossby and Doug Webb made this SOFAR float, which put out a lot of energy, drifted around in the sound channel, and was recorded by these, which turned out to be secret Navy listening posts. And so you could then track floats. And there was a big international experiment called MODE back in the 70s with Russians and various other people. And so it turned out the best data for the deep ocean were these floats. There are a lot of problems with the floats, too. They leaked and they had to be called back and reconfigured and sent back down. But it was very exciting. So for the first time, you could actually map a piece of the ocean quite well. And about that time, Bill Schmitz here at the Oceanographic started a group. And there's several of us worked in that for a long time. And we wanted to do a study in the Gulf Stream and the recirculation area. But to do that, we needed to have a moored listening station. It became difficult to use the Navy ones. And so Al Bradley here, an ocean engineer, developed the listening station. So you could put listening stations on moorings and then put your floats out, the SOFAR floats, which are beeping, and track them essentially anywhere in the ocean. And so I used those, or our group used those. And then Tom Rossby developed a Raphos float, which is SOFAR spelled backwards. And instead, you'd put a sound source on a mooring. And then you could have little floats that listen because it's easy to listen. You don't need big batteries like you do for sending the signal. And so they've been used all over the oceans. And I've used them a lot in the Atlantic. And the study we're talking about of the flow around South Africa, we used a lot of these Raphos floats with Germans, French, and Americans working together.
So for 30 years, you'd been studying how ocean currents move, these ocean eddies, clearly very exciting work. And yet, then you kind of get interested in the albatrosses and you're doing this. And I wonder if that project on a psychological or emotional level felt different, because it seems to tie together so many aspects of your life, your love of sailing and flying, which went all the way back to your childhood, combined with this broad interest in oceanography, tying together the physics and the biology. Was there a different kind of connection to this project, looking at how albatrosses soar, than to your other oceanographic research?
Well, it came about the right time, because I'd finished a major project. And I'd officially retired, so I had some time to think about something else besides writing another grant proposal. And so I read this National Geographic article about albatrosses, and that got me started in Google Dynamic Soaring, and I had a wonderful time exploring that. You know, what originally captured my interest was the albatrosses were using a technique to soar without flapping their wings called dynamic soaring using the wind shear. And I never heard of it. And I'd flown gliders, I'd flown airplanes. And then I started asking oceanographers. None of them had ever heard of dynamic soaring. So I thought, well, maybe this is something that would be fun to pursue. So I made this little model I was talking about, balancing the increase in airspeed using the shear layer with drag. And it turned out it was pretty good. And so I thought, well, maybe I should write this up and maybe some oceanographers would be interested in it. So I did.
Now, in the process of Googling dynamic soaring, you did find some people who were apparently aware of this, and it was remote controlled glider pilots. And you ended up getting in touch with some of these folks, going out and watching pilots, you know, flying their gliders. And it was, I mean, it sounds like it was a really eye-opening experience.
Oh, it was really fun. But you know, what got me going originally is that my simple model predicted that as the winds increases, the birds, albatrosses, airspeed increases linearly with the wind speed. So, you know, if the wind's blowing 50 miles an hour, albatross is going to be flying really fast. But the actual tracking data using GPSs showed that they tended to fly with the same airspeed. So I kept thinking, well, I wonder if anyone else has been using this technique. And so it turns out that radio-controlled glider pilots had discovered this, I don't know, about 12 or 13 years ago. Oh, it was before they were using updrafts over a mountain ridge. And I've seen them in California flying, doing that. But they discovered that if you fly on the backside of the mountain ridge, it's very similar to the albatross wave business. So if you have a glider climbing up through over the top of the ridge, he picks up a lot of speed through the increase in airspeed. And then through a circular pattern, you can increase your speed dramatically. And there are YouTube videos of these guys going like 300 miles an hour. I couldn't believe it.
It's incredible.
So anyway, there is this guy who kept breaking all their records, Spencer Lissenby. And so I emailed him, and he said, well, you know, you should come down and watch us. We usually do it in, I think it was April. Well, it turned out I was in California in April. So I said, well, where do you guys do it? He said, well, just east of Bakersfield. So come on down. He says, we've scheduled one. Looks like next Wednesday is going to be really strong winds. It turns out April's great for strong winds. So I had a friend with an airplane, so we flew down there and rented a car and went up to this place. It's called Weldon Hill. It's a very steep ridge, and you get on top. And the wind was howling. It was like 50 to 75 mile an hour winds up there. I was afraid the car would be blown off the hill. It was really amazing. So anyway, we're watching these glider pilots, and Spencer flew his, and it's an albatross sized glider. You know, it's a 100-inch wingspan, which is sort of typical to the albatrosses. And so he was flying it, and you launch it on the windward side, so you get a little bit of altitude, and then he dives down behind the hill into the low wind regime and starts doing these circles. And to get the speed, they use radar guns, sort of police-type radar guns. And so as the glider is coming around, it's going faster and faster. And you have to be there to appreciate it. The sound is amazing. And visually, the thing's going around in about 3 seconds. These are about 400-foot diameter circles.
I mean, it must just be a blur.
Well, it's very hard to make a video. If you look at the YouTube videos, it's hard to see them. So you watch these things. And so I was blown away. And so then I used my model and ended up writing a little paper about it, because they fly exactly as fast as my model said they would, you know, 10 times the wind speed, which is pretty incredible. But they're, you know, they're going so fast. Spencer has since gone 500 miles an hour with his glider. He's not in it. He's flying it. He's a radio control.
Right, so it's remote control.
And it's starting to approach speed of sound problems, the compressibility of air. So, you know, he's bumping up against that. So it's, I don't know how much faster they can go. I'm guessing maybe 550 or so, but it's stabilized around 500 miles an hour. So, but anyway, so I'm watching these things fly around. I'm saying, well, this is great. We'll make a robotic albatross using these gliders and fly over the ocean, but much faster than an albatross, because an albatross's wings are not that strong. So they can't do this. The gliders, they're going 500 miles an hour, they're pulling 100 Gs on their wings. The acceleration is 100 times gravity. And so for a long time, you know, all the gliders used to break, but they've gotten some really strong ones these days. And so I thought, well, let's just get one of these gliders and, you know, with a autopilot and some way to figure out how to soar over the ocean in the, just like an albatross, we could have a device that could go 10 times the wind speed.
Is this something that a glider could do autonomously without being driven by a human?
Oh, that's the whole idea. I tried to get these glider pilots to fly theirs over the ocean to test this concept. But they say, well, you know, we're just doing this for fun. They didn't seem to want to go on a ship out in stormy seas to try it. And their gliders are like $5,000, so they probably didn't want to crash them in the ocean.
Well, right. There's a limitation here in terms of what a glider could do compared to an albatross, because the albatrosses are flying so close to the waves,
right?
Especially with an autonomous vehicle that can't see and make a judgment call. You couldn't really get that close to the wings.
Right. Well, there are two things, of course. The wings are fairly long, so you can't get too close because they're banked steeply. So you have to have a certain clearance. And then just for safety, you can't go too close. So that's going to be that's why I was trying to get the glider pilots to figure out what the safety factor is. How close can you fly? To do efficient dynamic soaring, you have to drop down below the strong shear layer. And can you do that with a UAV, unmanned aerial vehicle?
Now, what would you want to use such a vehicle for? What would be the purpose of having an unmanned aerial albatross glider?
Well, I mean, there's several things that are popping to mind. One is, seems like the Coast Guard is always doing search and rescues, and usually it's bad weather, which means strong winds. You could send a small fleet of these out surveying a certain region. You can imagine oceanographic sampling, like sampling the air above the ocean, sampling the surface layer of the ocean using remotely, looking at the air-sea interaction. The wind interacts with waves and forms complicated structures, which also increases the waves, builds waves. So, you know, stronger waves, stronger winds make bigger waves. And so you could use these UAVs to look at that. And, you know, for oil spills, you could presumably follow oil spills or nuclear accidents you could in the ocean, such as Fukushima. You could follow that. Of course, you need wind. So, you know, when albatrosses run out of wind, they tend to flap their wings. So you'd have to put an auxiliary power on these things, maybe a battery-powered motor.
Are there visual recording techniques or any sort of data gathering instruments that could actually keep up with the speed at which these would be traveling? I mean, if you're going 50 or 100 miles an hour, you've got to be have something that's recording at a very high rate of speed to get any meaningful image or data back.
Well, even just GPSs have been difficult to use on albatrosses because you need high resolution in time to try to record their maneuvers. And so people have just started to do that now. But of course, you need more instrumentation. And I'm not an instrument developer, but I'd love to be able to get some money and have some of the ocean engineers here work on it.
So what is the state of this project? Are you actively pursuing going out there and testing a glider over the ocean?
I would love to, but I figure at this point, my idea is to promote the concept. I love the concept. And I'm retired, so, you know, I think I probably wouldn't be able to get a grant that's going to give me money to work on this. I mean, everyone knows me as an oceanographer, not an aerodynamicist. But so I'm trying to encourage others. And so I've written a couple of papers sort of talking about this concept. And I've been working on another paper because when I talk to people, they keep saying, well, yeah, you know, but how would they work their way upwind? You know, you need, if you're going to survey a region, a UAV has to go upwind. Turns out if you are able to fly like an albatross and use the wind shear between the wave trough and just above the wave, then you can go upwind. And the whole thing started when I was watching this albatross soar upwind. None of the numerical models that I've seen can simulate that at all. But my simple model does.
That's oceanographer and now glider expert Phil Richardson of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. You can find photos of the aerial gliders we've been talking about on our website, capeandislands.org. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.